Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. My guest today is, I think, one of the very, very most important voices in the field of psychology, psychiatry, mental health. He's one of the hopes for the future. He's been on the show before. But before saying more about him, if you go to my website, bregan.com, and look at the highlights at the top, I have a new article up that came out not very long ago. It's a scientific article, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, which looks at my theory that guilt, shame, and anxiety, in fact, have their evolution not in existential angst or simply in childhood trauma, that they are so embedded in every culture that they have to have an evolutionary function, biological evolutionary function, to suppress, to control the natural, willful, and aggressive tendencies of human beings in their personal, intimate relationships. I'm not going to talk more about the theory today, but I've laid it out in a scientific format, and it's, of course, the basis of my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. So you can have a kind of a more stodgy taste of it in terms of a scientific article on the website now, easy to get to. We put the link right up under the highlights at the top. And don't forget the book, because I really do think it's a help for us to understand that a lot of what troubles us has nothing to do with us. It's about our biologic inheritance that got stimulated in childhood before we can remember, so that so much of the emotion that we attribute so much power and influence to is all, in fact, prehistoric. Prehistoric in our history of evolving as a species, and prehistoric because the origins are also lost in the stimulation of these emotions in childhood. And I just think it's a great help to grasp that, to know that we can identify and leave behind these emotions and replace them with reason, with principled living, and with love. So much for reintroducing these ideas to you. My guest is Robert Whittaker. Bob, are you there? Hello, Bob.
Yes, I'm here, and I just want to say thank you for having me.
Oh, okay. I was got scared for a minute there. Where's Bob? Awesome.
No,
never
here.
Had him. Well, listen, there's not enough to be said about Robert Whittaker and what he is doing for reform in the overall field that all of us are interested in. He began even before he was publishing books. He started to write some critical articles. He did this out of conscience and out of scientific understanding, because he came straight out of the establishment. I noticed today in just reviewing Bob's background, which I've done a number of times, that he was actually, Bob, the director of educational books or something like that?
No, director of publications at Harvard Medical School.
At Harvard Medical School. I mean, that's... Well,
tradition
what
you can get.
You can't get more establishment than that.
No.
So Bob has really laid a lot on the line and paid a high price to speak truth to power. The first big book was actually, I'd say the big book was Mad in America. That's really the book that turned the field around, isn't it, Bob?
Well, Mad in America, I think, did introduce a sort of new narrative history from colonial times until today. I mean, it put a lot of things together, of course, and many people have been talking about elements of this history. But I think one of the things it did is it helped you know, we had this sort of common understanding that there were problems in the past, and then we had this modern psychopharmacology era, which was so wonderful. And I, one of the things I tried to do in that book was show that actually there's a link between that bad past and the bad today, and they're not the there's not this great separation between the two that the common wisdom says. And then I think the book Anatomy of an Epidemic, in some ways, was a sharper shot across their bow, so to speak, of mainstream psychiatry, because I just looked at their own research literature and asked a very simple question: does it show that psychiatric drugs, do they improve people's lives over the long term? And, you know, we, of course, drugs get approved because they may have some modest effect over the short term, which gets FDA approval. But I was asking, I think, the question that is so, vital to everyone who's taking these medications and to the society at large. And is it helping people, you know, over the period of 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? How is it affecting their lives? And I think the thing is, I just use their research. By their research, I mean NIMH-funded research, research funded by other governments, and certainly conducted by people who believe in the sort of medical model, the disease model that we've had for the last 35 years. So it was just sort of pulling back the curtain, so to speak, and saying, what did their study show? And what you find with extraordinary regularity and constancy is that time and again the research is showing that the medications, on the whole, are worsening long-term outcomes. And I think when that book came out, because it was clad in their own language and not in the language of critics, it did cause them to sort of, or at least many people, to take stop to stop and say, okay, what are we going to do with this?
Now, before getting on to your newest book, which I really want to give you all the time you want to talk about, Bob has done a lot more than just write books. He's really a kind of ambassador of rational thinking about psychiatry to the world. Two things that he's done that are very outstanding in that regard is the website Mad in America, which he obviously is the founder of. And that's probably the best online voice for people to talk about the various issues of what goes wrong in psychiatry, what would be a better approach to helping people. It's really quite a task to do a website like that, and Ginger and I consciously decided not to go the route of opening up a website which gave all the voices, because we didn't want the effort of having to monitor and edit and ride herd on that. And Bob has taken that on himself, and it's just a marvelous website. I enjoy occasionally writing on it myself, blogging on it myself. And the other thing that Bob did, and I'm sure there are many things I don't even know about, I'm sure, that is so important, is his books were really the whole impetus behind the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care, the foundation that you can learn about by listening to one of my recent radio shows. You can find it on our station, and you can also find it on Podbean, Bregan on Podbean. And that is when we had Bob and Gina Nickel on the air not long ago, talking about all of the excellent, really cutting-edge research and therapeutic alternatives that they're funding. And that simply wouldn't exist without Bob's written and personal influence on those two wonderful people, Bob and Gina Nickel. So Bob is doing a lot out there, folks, really a great, great deal. And I want to hear now about the impetus behind his new book, Psychiatry Under the Influence, which he's written with Lisa Cosgrove. So, right. Bob, the mic is yours to talk about your new book.
Okay, well, thank you. And you were very kind in that introduction, Peter. That was very, very
It's
kind
all true, though, right? No exaggeration.
Well, I just say one of the things we got going now is that we're trying, and I think you know about this as well, is we started this nonprofit that is actually housed within the foundation called Mad in America Continuing Education.
Yeah, we actually talked a lot about it. I want you to bring it up again, but we did talk about it with Virginia and Bob extensively.
Yeah, go ahead. It's part of this idea of bringing information to the public. So psychiatry and the influence arose in this way. Lisa Cosgrove, who is a professor at University of Massachusetts Boston, she's done some research looking at, basically, among many things, the financial conflicts of interest within psychiatry and how, you know, the pharma money goes to many academic psychiatrists, particularly those, say, involved with creating DSM-4 or creating DSM-5 and those diagnostic boundaries. So she was a fellow at this lab set up at Harvard University within this ethics center called the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, which was set up to study institutional corruption. And the idea was, let's look at institutions in the United States with public missions and look at what are the forces that cause them to become corrupt, and then what is the resulting social injury. So I was invited to join her in that lab and to basically look at the institution of psychiatry through this lens of institutional corruption. And we defined institutional psychiatry in this way, the American Psychiatric Association as being part of it, and then academic psychiatry being part of it. And together, those two groups, so to speak, really are the voices in our society that established the mainstream wisdom. And, of course, the APA publishes the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which defines mental disorders, which I think is the most powerful book published in the last 35 years. And by powerful, I mean in terms of changing our thinking, altering our society, altering childhood. It's a really... It has an extraordinary impact on our society. Anyway, so that was the institution that we decided to study because we see it is together those two really set the story that guides our care in this country. And it has the framework for institutional corruption, I think, is really great because it provides a way to illuminate the problem. So the first thing you do, you look at what are the economies of influence that are shaping that institution. And we know quite well, and ultimately corrupting that institution. And I think we all know quite well that pharmaceutical money has dramatically, it's an economy of influence, it's a financial influence that has dramatically shaped affected the American Psychiatric Association and academic psychiatry. So you can see, in 1980, As you know, the APA published the third edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and this is the moment it adopts a disease model where it says whatever it decides is, you know, wrong with a person or causing distress or some abnormal or some behavior that's causing distress to somebody will be seen as a disease. And the important thing about that conception is once you conceive of, say, anxiety or moodiness or children that are too anxious or too sort of hyperactive in class as a disease, now you have a conception that allows you to test a drug for that symptom and get it approved by the FDA. So it's a great model for expanding a drug market. Anyway, the minute they do that, the APA begins sending more and more money. The pharmaceutical industry begins sending more and more money to the APA. And you see the APA grows from this fairly small organization to a much larger one over the course of the next 25 years. So that's one source of money, one economy of influence. Then second, of course, what happened is that pharmaceutical companies began hiring academic psychiatrists to be their advisors, consultants, speakers, to serve as their thought leaders. Now, the individual academic psychiatrist tended to think, oh, look at me, I'm such a big, important person now. They're hiring me because I'm such a expert on this particular field, whether it be depression or anxiety, et cetera. But, of course, pharmaceutical companies had a very different understanding. What they knew the money was doing was helping them build markets for their drugs. And, of course, that money did co-opt the voice of that academic psychiatry and co-opted it in such a profound way such that the research they did was compromised, what they told the public was compromised, where they set diagnostic boundaries was compromised. It was a very much corrupting influence. So I think those two influences are well known. But we identified a second influence that I think is even much more powerful and much more harder to reform, and that is psychiatry's own guild interests. And what do I mean by a guild interest? Well, if we go back to the 1970s, psychiatry, in fact, is in competition for patients with a number of other professions. They're in competition with psychologists who are offering psychological therapies, social workers who are offering certain types of counseling, and there's all sorts of other sort of groups out there or professionals out there saying, we'll tend to your wounds. And at this time in the 70s, psychiatry with its talk therapies really couldn't prove that it was more, that its therapies were more effective than these other types of therapies. And that was one thing. And then there was also, you know, an anti-psychiatry movement questioning its legitimacy in society, questioning some of its more aggressive therapies, such as you did with lobotomy and electroshock. And there was this crisis moment. And so what does psychiatry do? It metaphorically puts on the white coat. It says, we're doctors like internal medicine doctors. We're going to adopt this disease model. And the minute it does that in 1980, where it says, we're going to start stating to the world that depression, anxiety, hyperactivity, whatever you want to say, are diseases of the brain. Now, that is a conception born of a guild need, because once you have diseases, who has domain over those diseases? Well, it's a medical specialty that has the authority over diseases. And two, they have prescribing powers, so they can prescribe drugs for those disorders, whereas psychologists and others can't. So it is a conception that clearly gives psychiatry a leg up on its other competitors. But now, so that's how it's presented. And really, if you go back to DSM-3, you can see they're saying, well, these are just hypotheses, that these are diseases of the brain. We really haven't made any new scientific discoveries showing that to be so. But now they have to sell this story to the public. And they start basically, and you can track this, developing a public relations capacity to sell that story. They train doctors in what to say. Of course, they develop their own, I'm talking about the American Psychiatric Association, they increase their own public relations capacities. And they had a very simple story that they've been telling for 35 years. And that is, these disorders are real disorders. They're real diseases. That's one. They're under-recognized and under-treated. So we've got to expand the market. And three, our drugs are very safe and effective for these diseases. And they've been telling us that for 35 years. And, of course, it has, it's a story that's benefited their guild interests. It's improved, it's dramatically increased the power of psychiatry in society, the influence of psychiatry over our society. Of course, it has made prescribing privileges more valuable. And of course, it's also helped this flow of money to APA and to academic psychiatry. So they're invested in that story. Now, the problem for psychiatry is, so we identify in psychiatry under the influence these economies of influence. You see pharmaceutical money and psychiatry's own guild interest to promote its profession, the profession of psychiatry. So we identify that. Then we look at the behavior, and the behavior is we start seeing that psychiatry is wedded to telling a certain story, the one I just said. Real diseases, under-recognized or under-treated, in other words, more people need treatment, and the drugs are very safe and effective. Now, that would be fine if their own science then actually supported that story. But what you find is when they did the research to see, to sort of, quote, validate it, the diagnoses in the DSM and show that they were
I got cut off for a moment. Technology does fail us now and again. Bob Whitaker,
yeah, now back
are you
on.
There?
I have no idea when I got cut off. I was going on at great length.
Well, no, it was just quite recent that I got cut off. So I don't know. This will be edited out probably a little bit when the show goes up. So, folks, you get to hear.
Okay, I thought we were live, actually.
We are live. We are live. But they'll probably edit it when the show gets put into its final storage for the world to listen to. So, folks, we're back again with Robert Whitaker. We only lost a few minutes, I believe, and Bob is talking about his book, Psychiatry Under the Influence, with Lisa Cosgrove, and it's an amazingly important work, the way he documents. I mean, one of the great skills that he has is that he works hard, and he really uncovers, digs deep, and gets to the heart of the matter, and one of the ideas that you were talking about at length was the guild idea.
Right,
and
I think
incredibly important.
Yeah, and I think to cut to the bottom line here is what you see because of that guild influence, and you see that psychiatry has told us a story that promotes its guild interests. Unfortunately, it's a false story, and by that I mean if you dig into the science, you see that the story they're telling us is not reflected in their own scientific findings. And so what that has resulted in is we as a society have organized ourselves, and individuals have organized their lives around a false narrative, one shaped by pharma money and one shaped by guild interests. And that is doing great harm to our society. And that's one of the things we do in this book is look at the harm being done in a big picture. It's what's the harm being done? Well, one is we've pathologized childhood. Two, of course, is we've invited many people into this category of mental patients. And as we've done that, you've seen a dramatic increase in the number of people disabled by mental illness during this modern time. I think, and this is something, Peter, I know that you've become more and more, you know, focused on, it also gives us this philosophy of being that is just so ahistorical. In other words, instead of that being a human being who's expected to have a range of emotions, including, you know, jealousy and all these things that we find in Shakespeare and novels, the DSM presents us with a position of human beings that are always well-behaved, kids are well-behaved, and our emotions are all under control. We're never sort of beset by strong emotions. It's such a false, reductionist, and impoverished philosophy of being. I think that's a huge problem with it. It takes away a sense of self-responsibility, so you have this bad philosophy as well. It also puts all the blame all the time on the individual. In other words, if you look at a kid who's bored in school, it's the kid's fault. It's not that maybe the school is a boring place to be. So you can start seeing that in essence the big picture harm is that we have organized ourselves around a false story, and of course a false story has been told about the effectiveness of the medications, particularly over the long term when you find, and Peter, you know, you were the very first to really nail this metaphor, and that is rather than these drugs fixing chemical imbalances in the brain, it's clear they induce dysfunction over the long term in different neurotransmitter pathways. I know you called it the brain disabling principle of psychiatry, and really that's what you do see long term. You see, increasing cognitive problems, physical problems, that sort of thing. So,
yeah, the basic theory there, as you well know, Bob, is that any good effect that we seem to be getting from a drug is actually a disability that somebody approves of. So that if we lobotomize somebody who's very anxious, upset, angry, maybe hallucinating, maybe has ideas that don't mesh with reality, we lobotomize them. It doesn't help them, but it makes it easier to manage them. The disability is for the managers. Or if we take benzos to suppress our anxiety by suppressing our whole alerting system, then the disability seems to please us because we don't suffer the anxiety as much. We don't realize that we're actually disabling our highest centers, which are how we could actually work our way out of and get beyond the anxiety. So the disability is actually the therapeutic effect, and it isn't a good way to go about trying to help ourselves.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. You become less engaged on some of these medications, less able to mount emotional reactions, less physically mobile sometimes. With the kids, of course, they become less interested in their environment. I'm talking about with the stimulants. And, of course, those are seen or viewed by those doing the treatment as positive changes. But these are not changes that help people, especially over the long term, cope better with the, you know, the challenges of life.
Yeah. One of the things I would emphasize, and I'm so glad you got into the philosophy side of it, because you're right, I've been thinking more and more about that, although I've kind of always thought about all these issues as one big problem. But and that is that psychiatry atomizes what is essentially a social experience, which is being a human being. So all these diagnoses, it's just like we're all just little single entities, like, you know, five different automobiles with five different problems that need to be fixed. And we're not like that. No animal is quite like that. No plant is even like that. We all live in this complex context. Our children are growing up in a world where their needs aren't being met in a million ways because of the difficulties in the family, the difficulties in school. And then we set these expectations on our children that they can't possibly conform to. And then we drug them to try to get them to conform to the expectations. There's a whole social matrix in which all human suffering takes place. Even physical pain is increased or decreased or helped or harmed by the social relationships and the social context. And emotional pain is often generated in those contexts. And psychiatry, in order to justify drugging individuals, has this very atomized view of what life is about. And it's just simply not about that.
Yeah, you know, I think this is so extraordinary. I mean, with their, quote, disease model in 1980, they locate everything within the brain of the individual as if that brain exists apart from the world. And everything we know about ourselves is, of course, we're individuals. I mean, we, human beings, are made to interact with our social environment and to respond to it emotionally in every single way. And, of course, anybody who's been alive any sort of time, any length of time, and grown up to be adult, recognizes that their moods change with context, their feelings change, their physical nature changes. So what we, of course, experience is that our lives, our sense of self, arises from those in-between spaces. By that I mean the very social context you're talking about. And it can change so much depending on those social interactions. Do we have someone to love? Is someone loving us? Do we have a job? Do we have meaning in life? Those sort of things. And we have been given this model, starting with DSM-3, that just strips everything away. It doesn't matter what the social context is. Do you have this distressed? Okay, that's the problem. Are you bored in school? Then it's the problem is with you and inside your mind. It's as if that the book were written by people who, you know, almost have never, you know, have no sense of being, so to speak, no sense of how their own world works. Because of course it's all social context. You know, that's who we are. We're social creatures.
A very good place to take our break, folks. You're listening to Robert Whittaker eloquently talk about the problems in our current way of looking at mental and emotional and spiritual issues. We'll go to break and music.
Hi. This is Tony Hendra.
And Jeff Chrysler.
Of the Final Edition Radio Hour.
On PRN.
Your source for organic,
gluten-free,
sustainable
satire.
Gary Null's incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial issues have won dozens of international awards. As a free service to listeners, acclaimed films such as War on Health and Seeds of Death are available to watch in their entirety online. Just go to YouTube and search for Gary Null. Thank you for your continued support.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan returning to you with Robert Whitaker. Robert Whitaker is the author of Mad in America, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and now Psychiatry Under the Influence. Bob's background is in journalism, but in my opinion, he's one of the outstanding scientists of our time in our field, because what he does is genuine scientific research and genuine scientific examination of the research in our field. Bob is also today showing us another side of himself, which is the larger analysis of just how bad for society, for our culture, for our family life, the medical model is, this atomistic model, like we are all these like separate molecules. I mean, are we even molecules? What are we? We're, molecules relate to other molecules, and then they form compounds. I mean, in the view of psychiatry, we don't even have the general attraction for each other that atoms and molecules have. We're isolated bits to be examined like under a microscope, but only very briefly to justify giving drugs to, rather than very complex. The most complex spot in the universe is you and me and Bob. I mean, these we're more complex individually than the whole universe. Life is that complex, and human life, the most complex of all that we know about. And we have to see ourselves in the context of our evolution, then our personal growth and development, the cultures and societies we're in, and to reduce the anguish and pain and suffering that we go through as something wrong in our mechanism, our individual mechanism, is not just absurd. I think it's evil. I think it's evil. Bob, I give the mic back to you.
Well, no, I think really this is, you know, one of the, when you write a book, you hope you are changed by the book and you hope you learn from the book. And, you know, in my first two, in, like, say, the last book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, I looked at a very specific question. You know, what was the science showing us about long-term outcomes as defined by their own science? But you know, because of this framework of institutional corruption, it does ask you to think about, well, what's the social injury when you have an institution that's supposed to be serving a public mission betray that public mission, and then what is the resulting harm? And when you do that, the social injury, it ultimately brings you to this very question. It's given us a ridiculously impoverished philosophy of being, which we now start, and think about how pervasive it becomes. Parents start seeing their children through this new lens. Oh, you know, my child is depressed or moody, and that's wrong. Well, you're just ridiculous. Or my child doesn't want to sit still in school for 7 hours. You know, that's as if that's normal. So we view our children that way. But then the children start seeing themselves this way. Oh, something must be wrong with me if I'm anxious or, you know, moody or depressed or, you know, that sort of thing. Or I hate school. When I was a kid, almost everybody hated school, it seemed to me, and I couldn't wait to be out every day. And my point is, we start internalizing that, oh, this is what's normal. This is how I'm supposed to be. So it gives us a false internal sense of how to judge ourselves. It gives us a false sense of how to judge kids, how to judge our mates. It is harming us in so many profound ways, in the ways you're talking about. I mean, I think suffering is part of being alive. Grieving is part of being alive. Feeling anxious, feeling at many times overwhelmed. But part of that, if you have that sense of life, and I keep saying read your Shakespeare and read novels, because, of course, that's what we see all the time. What you also see, of course, is an extraordinary resilience. We're not these steady state creatures that, oh, I'm anxious now and I'm going to always be anxious, or I'm depressed now, I'm going to always be depressed. What we find is we, of course, have these fluxes. And part of the things about confronting these difficult times as children, as young adults, is we develop a resilience. We develop strategies. We change our ways. And then we also, of course, when we find refuges and we fall in love, you know, we cherish them. So in one way, we have this philosophy of being that cultivates you to say, what's wrong with me? Why do I have these feelings of distress? And I'm never going to be able to cope with them. And think about this. In some colleges now, more than 50% of our college students need to access psychiatric services or psychological services in their 4 years. That shows how we're breeding a lack of sense of inner resilience. And then this other world that you're talking about, one that recognizes that suffering is part of it, and that, if you ask me, I think the big part of growing up is learning to sort of deal with your mind and deal with all its difficulties. That sort of sense of life is so much richer and is so much more full-bodied, and of course is obviously consistent with what we know through history, literature, religion, evolution, and that's what we're losing. And I can't think of anything more profound than losing a philosophy of being that helps a society be resilient, and replacing it instead with a society that teaches us to be weak and think we can't change and think we can't cope. And it's the social injury that is being done is just astonishing. And you see it most clearly, I think, in what's happening to our children by the time they hit 18, 19, and so many of them now think that, you know, that they're disordered, can't cope with things. I mean, that is great harm that is being done.
Very, very well put. And folks, I want to remind you that also on the website, you know, you can get my paper that came out last year, not very long ago at all, in Childhood and Society, where I just come out and say it's time to begin looking at how can we call for a ban on giving psychoactive substances for children for the control of their emotions and behavior. But how can we go about explaining, convincing people that it's simply the wrong way? It's the wrong way. And I don't think there's any other way to look at it. I think it's a form of institutionalized child abuse. I don't think it's a child abuse that starts in the head of the parents or even the teachers. It's a child abuse that starts in the heads of the leaders in psychiatry and medicine, who are pretty much, as Bob's title says, psychiatry under the influence, pretty much under the influence of a vast, powerful industry that has corrupted our culture. I'm so glad to hear the way Bob's talking about it. Another way of looking at it is psychiatry's robbed us of Western civilization. The whole idea that life is a challenge, that there's a huge variety of ways of dealing with life and growing through life and creating, that we do struggle, that it's often a life and death spiritual struggle we have to come to grips with, and that we do it through not just ourselves, but through love, through God, for me and for many other people, through a belief in higher values and something greater than ourselves. I mean, there's just so many different ways. And literally, when you go to the psychiatrist and tell him you're anxious or sad, and he gives you a drug, he has ripped Western civilization out of you and put in something the equivalent of what? A funnel? Pour drugs in? I mean, ugh. Bob, back to you.
Well, no, you know what's interesting about this history of Western civilization? You can actually track this very clearly related to conceptions of depression. Going all the way back to the Greeks and all, there was a sense that there could be this, you know, rare sort of melancholy that hit people that seemed out of proportion to the context or persisted unduly long, and so that there was a disorder there. But that was, not so frequent. And then there was always this understanding that you needed to look at the context, because if someone was grieving or distressed and you could see the context, that was normal. And then in 1980, with the publication of DSM-3, they said context, the APA says context doesn't matter. You just look, is the person not sleeping? Do they have these symptoms? It doesn't matter what's happening to their life. So they literally turned their back with the publication of DSM-3 on this long tradition, going back to the Greeks, saying that of course context has to be considered, and of course it's normal to suffer and grieve. And, you know, the opposite side of this, of course, Peter, is that there's this resilience within human beings, and a resilience that builds from social context that allows us to surmount those difficulties and move on with our lives. And you can see in history, people have suffered terrible, terrible, terrible losses and rebuilt their lives. But our new DSM world doesn't even give us this credit for having the capacity for resilience. So that's all to the harm done, and I think we need to focus on that. And you know, going to child abuse, and you know, what is the responsibility of a society? Well, responsibility of a society is to create a nurturing environment to give every child the chance to make something of themselves and to come to grips with their own minds and support them in that. And instead, we're pathologizing kids. I can't think of, and giving them meds that make them less engaged, less able to move about, that sort of thing. I can't hardly think of anything that is more harmful to that child, especially when you add in the sense that, oh, you're not normal, you're not right. So we really need to think about all these things, and just to go back to this framework of institutional corruption. So you look at these influences, the guild influences and the pharmaceutical influences that shape thinking. Then you look at the social injury, and then you ask this question. Well, why don't people recognize it? I'm talking about people within the institution. Why don't they see the harm done? Why don't they see the way that their behavior has been corrupted and how they're setting diagnostic boundaries that create markets for drugs, including turning children into a market? And there, that takes you into a sense of, you know, a cognitive dissonance, basically. I also think it takes you into how medical training today so often is basically a form of acceptance of some doctrine, almost in a brainwashing way. But why doesn't academic psychiatrists see this problem? And I think there you get into the sense of, if you have a profession, or if you have something that is creating in the individual and in that profession, money, power, prestige, and within society, this place of authority, well, those people in that who are reaping those rewards will create a narrative that allows them to see themselves as doing good. So, of course, what they come to think of is they sort of buy their own story. That these, you know, are real disorders, that they're under-recognized and under-treated, that the drugs are very effective. And then what do? Well, they say those who are criticizing that or critiquing that, oh, they kill the messenger, that person's biased, that sort of thing. And if long-term studies come out that show that the unmedicated patients are doing much better, well, they find a way to dismiss those results. And the important thing of this is, when to delve into cognitive dissonance, is once you see that the guild interests are so strong, and there's this cognitive dissonance at the heart of modern psychiatry, well, then you can see that it's not going to be a solution just to say, can we in some ways minimize this influence from pharmaceutical money on academic psychiatrists or on the APA? Because even if you minimize that, the guild interest is going to stay. And then the question becomes, well, how are you going to minimize this guild interest where psychiatry has asserted its authority over our society in this profound way? And you see that basically the only solution, because psychiatry itself, the leaders of this, are not going to see themselves in this corrupt light, is to somehow strip psychiatry of its sort of ruling authority and somehow have society invest the authority in a multidisciplinary, a larger group of individuals, which would include philosophers and that sort of thing. But you, at least from my point of view, the only solution is you can't expect the solution to come from within psychiatry. It's not going to reform itself. And that we as a citizenry have to say, listen, you have told us a false story. We have to become aware of that. We now have organized our society around a false story. That's doing great harm. So we have to create a new authority over this domain of our lives. And we have to search for a multidisciplinary authority, I think, and one that, in fact, is leavened by philosophy, religion, history, that sort of thing, and not just some sort of medical approach.
One of the things that I learned during my doing my show was when I had Michael Fontaine on. Michael is a professor of classics at Cornell, and he's gotten interested in Zas, and then he learned about me, and he started just getting very interested in all this. And he found, and he discusses this on the radio show, again, you can find, just go to Podbean and or to PRN-FM, and you can find my show with Fontaine, F-O-N-T-A-I-N-E. And he found that very shortly after Hippocrates began to talk about the humors and the physical disorders, and to try to build a field for psychiatry, we're talking about hundreds of years B.C., a playwright came out ridiculing it.
which the playwright, and this
is so long ago that the play is only found through some other translation that you find discover the play, but not directly from the playwright. And the play makes fun of the psychiatrist in terms of who's crazy and determines at the end that it's the psychiatrist who's crazy and not the patient he's trying to lock up against his will. It's quite amazing. And so from the very beginning, thoughtful people have seen through this psychiatric mirage. And although it's vastly intensified its power, as Bob is describing, 1980 being this big moment, but also the early 60s, when psychiatry literally decided to go into cahoots with the drug companies, which I document in Toxic Psychiatry. They just made a decision. We're going to partner with the drug companies because, as Bob was describing, we can't compete with all the other therapists. But even going back, way, way back, before psychiatry had such massive power, thoughtful people were looking at this this fraudulent story, as Bob says. It's just that now, for the first time, it's had a grip on our whole society, a process that Bob describes in Psychiatry Under the Influence. It has a grip on all of our society, and in particular, it's ruining our children, starting in infancy now. I had Gordon Smith on, as a physician, talking about how hundreds of thousands of children under age one are now being placed on psychiatric drugs, under age one. It's absolutely bizarre what's going on.
You know, I mean, I have to say, when you hear this, and it's true, okay, putting a six-month-old child on a psychiatric drug is such insanity. I mean, there's no possible... I don't even know how you can conceive of doing that. You know the drug is going to change that child's brain. You know it's going to profoundly affect that young child. It's as if it's being done without even the beginning worry about how the brain it was, you know, honed by evolution to develop, and now you're going to throw a big wrench into it. I honestly, when I hear of medicating really young children, I can only gasp at just the lack of thought that is present when that happens. It's just incredible to me.
It makes you question human nature. I mean, one of the issues you've raised is just how the my colleagues, I'm a psychiatrist, my colleagues end up justifying what they are doing and believing in their own story and wanting to believe they're doing good. Yet I do think that on some level, this kind of abuse has got to have more violent motivations behind it, more destructive feelings. I don't particularly want to take the show in that direction, unless you have an urge to, which I doubt. But
I don't have an urge to go there at all.
we'll just say, folks, I want to remind you there's such a thing as evil viewpoints and evil attitudes. One of the things I think is that once you begin to treat people as an object, you have to hate them. That you can't view somebody. That we're not indifferent to people. We're not neutral. We don't have a neutral gear in how we relate to people. We either are going to embrace people as human beings, equal and as valuable as we are, or we're going to reject them and do bad things to them. The human beings just don't seem to glide through life with a neutral gear. I've never quite put it that way. I'm rather pleased with that metaphor. And I think that psychiatry's attempt to objectify human relationships and human issues and to place it within the object of the individual flawed human leaves them with a fundamentally hateful, destructive attitude toward people. Again, I'm not going to ask Bob to comment on that. We have about 6 minutes left, 5 minutes left. I'm so glad to be having this kind of thoughtful interchange with you. Remember, folks, that Bob and I have this huge amount of science behind what we're doing, and his books and my books are literally just filled with the scientific basis for what we're talking about today. Bob, we've got just a few minutes left. What would you like to talk about as we get toward finishing?
Well, I guess, you know, I've reached this point after many, many years of thinking about this and writing about this. I think this is in some ways the great challenge for our society today. I'm talking about the fact is, how do we respond to the way psychiatry has reshaped our society? And as I said, I think it's, and as we've been talking, I think it's reshaped in a way that's doing extraordinary harm to us. And so the question for me is, well, okay, now what do we as a citizenry do, and how can we do it, and what's the approach? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, if you look at how our society is run, once it gets organized around a story, it tends to stay organized, and there's a lot of financial interest now invested in a particular story we have. And then, of course, psychiatry, we really honor doctors, so they have a medical legitimacy. But I think we have to say, what, as a citizenry, how are we going to take back, our philosophy, so to speak? How are we going to rebuild a real philosophy? And I think, you know, one way to do it, of course, is to challenge psychiatry and say, well, look, you're telling us this story, but now look at your science, and there's a huge gulf, that they're out of sync. And so I've been thinking about trying to, you know, so can we have these sort of challenges? And really the question to me is, how does society become informed about this problem? And then how does it get motivated to do something? And I think that's the big question for us now. How do we become better informed? And how do we say, as a citizenry, we don't want this impoverished philosophy of being. It's not serving us well. It's not serving our children well. And we want to completely rethink psychiatry and rethink this domain and do so along on that incorporates philosophical principles and beliefs and understandings. So the point is, now I'm sort of lost, Peter. I mean, I think, what is the next step? How do we how do we respond to this harm done? I think that's the big challenge that we need to think about as a citizenry.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And, of course, both of our lives are kind of devoted to trying to solve that problem. One of the things that, it's so interesting the way the conversation is going, because one of the things that I've been doing for the last few months is I've gone back to writing novels. You know, I have two published novels from the early 70s. And that was how I first sort of took on the profession. One of the ways I first took it on, 1970, with a novel called Crazy from the Sane. And which was about my experience in my residency, and I kind of wrote myself out of conventional thinking. As you said, had books change you? When you first said that books change you, I said, oh, that's a cute thing to say. And then I just realized, of course, what books I write change me.
No, they do. They absolutely do.
That novel really changed me because I kept looking for redeeming features to conclude the novel with, and I couldn't find any. So the book ends up very depressing. I wouldn't even recommend reading it particularly because I think a book should lift us up. But I couldn't find anything to lift myself up with as a resident in psychiatry. I'm writing a novel now, and I'm hoping that in that format I can begin to communicate more and more with people on the basis of what I know about what life should be about, what it can be about. And I'm not even going to address psychiatry at all.
Well, I think fiction is a great place to be part of this discussion. I mean, thinking we need fiction in our lives because, of course, novels ultimately tell us a lot about human beings and social interactions and what it means to be alive. So,
yeah, and that's because we're so complicated, like you've been saying. Every human, you think about. You go into any doctor's office now, you tell him three words and he gives you a drug. Like, he knows, he understands why you're anxious or depressed or something like that. And yet, if you want to understand a great figure in history like Lincoln or Churchill or anybody else, George Washington, there's maybe 1,000 books trying to figure him out.
Exactly.
1,000 books, maybe novels and plays and biographies and research theses and all this trying to figure out a human being.
Right.
And psychiatry gives it to you in a book, the DSM.
And you know,
Bob,
Peter, maybe the thing
up.
Is, no, maybe fiction will give us back the mystery of being human.
Yeah. Folks, I just very much enjoyed today talking with Robert Whittaker, his new book, Psychiatry Under the Influence. I hope you've enjoyed listening to us. I think we've come to meaningful places to look at. Thanks so much, Robert Whittaker, for being on.
Thanks for having me.